So good morning, everybody. It's Sunday morning. We are here. This is Lizzie and Justin from Third Space for, I've counted this correctly this week, week 75 of our unbroken practice of bringing you and inviting you into a conversation every Sunday morning, which we've been calling in various ways a deep dive into big questions of human living. And I feel like it's a practice for me to say something that's true every time, which is it is so delightful to be here and to have a feeling of Lizzie, you and I being in conversation and then people joining us. So I want to say welcome to all of you who are joining us. We know many of you join us live on a UK time Sunday morning from around the world, and that many other people are watching or listening in various ways from the archives that we have, which by the way, you can always find at turningtowards.life. And we have a wonderful source this morning, which Lizzie has chosen. So I'm not going to say any more for the moment, Lizzie, so you can say things and we can get going.
Cool. Good morning, everybody. Thank you, as always, for being with us. It, as Justin says, is truly a delight that we do this and feeling the rhythm of it and the this is what we do-ness of it is a real beautiful thing for me. So I'm very, very grateful to be here. So this source, just a little tiny bit of background. So at the moment, I am in a coaching relationship with a very, very lovely person with whom I have agreed, we've agreed to study this wonderful book, The Wild Edge of Sorrow by Francis Weller, which I think we've mentioned maybe before, because I think Justin, you selected a source from it before.
About 71 weeks ago.
Approximately.
It was when we last looked at, yeah.
And I am so moved by Francis Weller's writing as I'm actually reading it again and feeling it all again. And it's such a beautiful book. And the topic is so wide, actually, the topic of grief. And it's not just about the typical notion of grief, but it's all kinds of ways that we have to let go of things in our lives. And in that inquiry, I visited Francis's website and thought, you know, I wonder what poems he has, and, you know, there's poems throughout it and everything. And I found this section of his writing. And funnily enough, this huge big piece about self-compassion came up. And this is something that I have been an advocate for so long. And I haven't really found great amounts of writing on it that have spoken to me in this particular way. And some of the language I normally use is self-appreciation. And it feels like the seeing of ourselves is such a big part of our development as human beings, which we rarely get taught, because often we don't want to be seen, and or the people who taught us how to be in the world didn't want us to be seen as arrogant or self-congratulatory or something. And so we've, as a culture, I think, steered away from this thing. And yet I do think it's such a big thing to turn our kindness upon ourselves and to turn our compassion upon ourselves and to remember that compassion doesn't only include other people, but also includes this one as well. So I'm really excited to discuss this and talk about this with you, Justin, and also just to say hello to this wonderful client who knows who she is and say thank you for the conversation that we're in, because it's guiding us in such a beautiful way. So I am going to begin, and then Justin, you'll read whatever you think, because it's quite long. So yeah.
Lizzie, before you do, as often when you're wearing a glorious scarf, like your wonderful purple scarf today, your microphone is just rubbing a little bit against it as you're moving and talking, so it's scratchy.
I'm going to hold it out like this. Okay, so here we go, folks. So this is, just to begin with, Francis Weller begins with a quote by Buddha. You can search throughout the universe for someone who is more deserving of your love and affection than you are yourself. And that person is not to be found anywhere. You yourself, as much as anybody in the entire universe, deserve your love and affection. So Francis begins, at the heart of every spiritual tradition, we find the teaching of compassion. Through the gate of compassion, we are invited to enter the wider conversation with all life. Compassion binds us with all things through the shared encounter with suffering. Compassion, from the Latin, combati, to suffer with. It's through our experience with loss, sorrow, and pain that we deepen our connection with one another and enter the commons of the soul. But how are we with self-compassion? Too often our caring is reserved for those outside of ourselves, as though we haven't earned the right for kindness. We struggle with judgments and resist offering gestures of mercy to ourselves. Yet every one of us knows loss and defeat, loneliness and failure. We hurt and harm others. We are hurt and harmed by others. We close our hearts to the world and often choose self-protection as the way of life. Bringing compassion to our suffering is an act of generosity. It helps us remember that we too are part of this breathing, pulsing world and worthy of compassion. We are reminded that by the mere fact of our being here, we qualify for the soothing waters of compassion. We can then come out of our sheltered world of self-scrutiny and make our way back into the fuller embrace of our belonging. So often our efforts at change in our lives mask subtle and not so subtle acts of self-hatred. We attack portions of our life with a vengeance, fully believing that our weakness or inadequacy, our neediness or our failures are the reasons for our suffering. And if only we could be free of them, then we would enter into a state of perfection. All would be well. Our obsession with perfection is itself a strategy that we cling to overcome our feelings of being outside the wall of welcome. Giving up our muscular agendas of self-improvement is an act of kindness. It says that by befriending our life, we deepen our capacity to welcome what is, what comes, whoever arrives at the interior door of our soul's house. We don't often get to decide who or what shows up at the guest house, as Rumi says, but we can cultivate an atmosphere of curiosity and receptivity. Self-compassion gradually becomes one of the basic elements of maturation. We slowly relinquish the harsh programs of ridding ourselves of our outcast brothers and sisters for the sake of fitting in. We simply set another place at the table. The foundations of self-compassion arise from the fertile ground of belonging. Belonging confers a feeling of worth and value, which in turn filters into our whole being as a blessing. This gently translates into a relationship with oneself that is respectful and caring. Herein lies our problem. For many of us, the experience of belonging has been fractured and frustrated. We often feel as though we are living outside the warmth of a recognizable welcome. In this state of exile and loneliness, we feel unworthy of compassion or kindness. It's very challenging to cultivate a feeling of compassion for oneself in an atmosphere of self-judgment and hatred. Self-compassion is a fierce and challenging practice. Every day we are asked to sit with pieces of our interior world that lie outside of what we find acceptable and welcome. We must explore our learned responses to our places of suffering and actively engage these pieces of soul life. We've often treated these parts of ourselves with indifference, if not outright contempt. Self-compassion is not an event, but an ongoing daily practice. It is the root practice of our inner life and also our relational lives. I remember giving many talks on shame and sharing how we want to be in loving relationships while simultaneously hating ourselves. Our ability to receive love is proportional to our capacity to welcome all of who we are. Self-compassion is a skill that needs to be exercised and developed regularly in order for us to remain open and available to life. It is the gift of a generous heart.
How wonderful is that? I'll just read a couple of parts. Giving up our muscular agendas of self-improvement is an act of kindness. It says that by befriending our life, we deepen our capacity to welcome what is, what comes, ever arrives at the interior door of our soul's house. We don't often get to decide who or what shows up at the guest house, as Rumi says, but we can cultivate an atmosphere of curiosity and receptivity. Self-compassion gradually becomes one of the basic elements of maturation. We slowly relinquish the harsh program of ridding ourselves of our outcast brothers and sisters for the sake of fitting in. We simply set another place at the table.
That's so beautiful.
It's my favourite paragraph of the whole. I mean, it's all wonderful. And when you posted this the other day, Lizzie, one of the first, I had this, I laugh at it now. My first thought was, well, I'm really bad at that. And then I had all kinds of judgments about my own, that of myself that is finds it difficult to be self-compassionate in that way, which of course is an example of exactly the beautiful paradox here is, can we even welcome, can I welcome that of myself, which is not compassionate towards myself? Can I welcome that of myself that wants to judge and compare myself with myself and myself with an apparent imaginary me and myself with other people and myself with you? And so it's that for me is the one when I spot it, which I do now and again, is both the most liberating and also the most difficult, because it's so shadowy and shape-shifting, this that of myself that keeps on throwing me into comparison and judgment. But when I, that's why I found this, where is it? What I just read. Simply setting another place at the table is such an extraordinary and beautiful metaphor. I'm sitting, nobody can probably see, but I'm sitting at a table, our dining table right now, with a bunch of empty chairs, and just imagining what it is for all of the parts of myself that I want to rid myself of and all the parts that I judge, and including, and I think this feels really important to me because it's the way that it most often shows up for me, is including the sense of lack or of absence. So I less often obviously for myself get myself into, well, I hate this part and I hate this part. What I mostly experience it as is the absence of something that I think I should or ought to be. So if I can even welcome that of myself that is the apparent absence, or that of myself that is caught up with the absence, and say, welcome, come and sit here to my left, come and sit here to my right, that is a revolutionary move.
Yeah, when I read this to Matthew, my husband, yesterday, and funnily enough, it was that paragraph that we then began to talk about, because this whole notion of setting another place at the table was so kind of imagination kind of opening, and I could find a way, because of that metaphor, I could find a way of going, okay, so if something came along, when something comes along, I know what it means for someone to come to the door and we're already having dinner, and I set another place at the table. You know, it's like it's in my, I can imagine that. So I love that he used that language. And I feel like this orientation that he then reaches at the end is so much to do with this too, which is when we want to be in relationship with other people, we want to be loving, and we're giving ourselves a horribly hard time. It affects, and so the way we're treating ourselves, the way we speak to ourselves, becomes the way we speak to other people. And that's just become so clear to me, that if I don't find those parts that I've exiled, that I've pushed away, it's so hard for me to be loving towards another in that part of them that I've rejected in myself. And I so appreciate how Francis writes about the proportionality of our self-compassion is related to the way that we can be loving. And, you know, often, I don't know about you, Justin, but I've had challenges in my life where people just say, oh, the stupid stuff that you do, it's just navel gazing. And, you know, particularly kind of very scientific people, or people who don't really have much of a relationship within the emotional realms, but it's much more of a rational relationship to life. And often in the moment, I have no response, and I just feel like a bit of an idiot, and I just go, oh, okay. And I mean, I think I've got stronger in being an advocate for this work as I've grown up. But there's always been the part of me that has to reflect on that, because I get kind of triggered and I think, what the heck is what are people talking about? How can people not think this is beautiful and important and integral to being a human being, to study one's humanity? And this has been a real kind of bedrock for me. Like, you know, how do I be loving if I don't do this work? And to be loving and to be accepting and open and curious and cultivating this atmosphere of curiosity, if I don't see what I'm doing to myself, it's impossible for me to see what my place in relationship is, what my impact is on other people. And that's such a robust, in the moments where I've had to reassure myself of why on earth I'm doing this, then if I'm so weird or I'm so out of normal realms of what I should be doing, how do I justify it? And this has been a big, I suppose, confidence instiller in me, is that I know this, like I actually know this practice of self-appreciation and self-compassion and what impact it has on my relationships with people. And if I didn't have that, I don't know how I would work with it when I get really annoyed with people, or I'm really impatient, or I'm really judgmental. And it happens a lot. But if I didn't have anything to do with it, like that would be where it stopped. And that's kind of not okay. Like I can't stay in the place and feel like I'm having integrity without saying, well, how am I being? What did I say that had that effect? And how can I listen for what happened in terms of somebody's experience and how I may have judged them? And if I can't then bring self-compassion to myself, it just has to perpetuate. So I protect myself from whatever the dynamic is, whatever the person is saying to me. So at the beginning, when Francis said, you know, we've built these lives where we have a way of life of self-protection. Like I could totally see that option exists for all of us. But we judge somebody, they get upset, and we carry on judging, because if we really access that part of us that was judging them, and if we did have self-compassion, we'd have to be accountable. And of course it feels awful to be responsible for hurting someone or doing something wrong. And so without self-compassion, the cycle just keeps going. And so the value of this feels absolutely huge and completely central, I think, to all of our being the kind of human that most of us wish to be inside our own inner world, and therefore in relationship with others.
I couldn't help thinking whilst you were talking about all of this about when you were talking about being weird. I so appreciated that you said weird, because I think weird is really called for here in a good way, which is that seriously considering what Francis Weller is inviting us into is enormously countercultural. One of the reasons why it's enormously countercultural is, at least in these parts, Lizzie, where you and I grew up, the myth, the commitment to us being separate individuals, separate from one another, like a separate self, and my job is to get by in the world and get what I want, is the primary story. And we're much more interested in the outer than the inner. We have been anyway in our culture. And so even the shame or self-judgment we might feel about paying attention to what's inner is part of the process of keeping us separate from a whole part of life.
Yeah.
And so even in that, I was imagining a dialogue with someone who says, well, your attention to this is a waste of time, or it's self-indulgent or something. What I got interested in was, then there's the parts of me that come up that are then judging of them, or judging of myself, or judging. And the whole place that I think I'm trying to get to, and what I'm saying, is what I could see from Francis Weller's invitation is that when we get into the habit of welcoming with a proper welcome, like you would do someone coming to the door and saying, "Come in, sit at the table." And you know, when we, and this is wonderful to do with people we know really well, but when somebody new comes to the door and we can feel our own curiosity, bless you. Who are you? Like, I want to know about you. You're sitting at my table. Tell me about your life. When we can bring that kind of curiosity to, so for me, it's very, as I've spoken here very often, it's very often fear. One of the things we find out, I think, we get a glimpse of is I'm really not separate from anybody or anything else. I may have this very particular body and this particular history and, you know, my particular preoccupations and everything. But when I really look, I get that I'm afraid because you're afraid because everybody's afraid. And I judge because you judge because everybody judges. And I love because we all love, because it's the nature of things that all of this is present. It is deep expression of a way that things are. And so practicing when we can this kind of welcome, this kind of knowing all of us as belonging and then knowing us as belonging is, like you were saying before, so difficult to talk about this without it having to be a path for the sake of something else. Like, it's of deep value in and of itself that we simply get to take up our place. But it also means that if I can really welcome those moments when I can really welcome my own self-criticism, it means I no longer have to have you be somebody who is a particular way that you won't trigger my self-criticism. Then you can be, then you, Lizzie, can be as you are. I may have requests of you for, you know, all kinds of things, but I don't fundamentally have to have you be a different person because I'm so caught up in the act of carving off parts of myself and now I need you to fit in with
yes.
Only that which I can tolerate in myself. So we free ourselves. We free ourselves to be here, and we free other people to be here as well, I think, is partly why, one of the many, many reasons why this matters.
Yeah. Yeah, it's such a kind of, I find myself in this kind of fuzzy place in my mind when we get to this point about self and other, and the bits that I can't accept in myself are the bits that I can't have you exhibiting, otherwise I can't tolerate you, because it's such a weird thing to get our heads around that we're not separate, you know, it really, really. And it's also a really big thing to do, you know, to let go of these big requirements that we have of how we should be and how other people should be. And of course, difference and diversity and everyone being who they are is like completely crucial to the world being beautiful. And yet so much of the time we go around with these standards of how everybody should be that basically line with our opinion of things, which is a really small way to be, if you know what I mean. Like, oh, you have to be, you know, like you have to be good, or you have to be kind. And I often see this with all the children in our family, like, you know, what demands do we have on them socially to be a certain way? Otherwise we feel ashamed because they're associated with us. And how do we bring curiosity to that rather than just be in response to our shame? And it's a really big piece of work. You know, it really, really, really touched me when you said it can even be a source of shame that we look inwards because the cultural norm is not to do that. And I have really felt that, like in that moment when I'm being challenged, just, you know, well, what the hell are you doing reading all these books and meditating and going to live in an ashram and whatever. I feel like when I was transitioning into that world, I was also in a more ordinary world where I'd go to, you know, a wedding or an event or something, and somebody would ask me what I did. And I used to question whether I should even say anything, because the conversation that would come would be so kind of aggressive sometimes, and it would bring up this shame in me of like, oh God, you know, maybe I am doing the wrong thing and maybe it is a waste of time and all this kind of thing. So I have really felt that shame. And in response to that shame, we can do extraordinary things. You know, I've noticed myself over time bending and buckling myself to not feel that in all kinds of ways. And it's such a big inquiry as to how to overcome that, how to not just be in response to our shame and act in line with what our shame tells us to do. And so even feeling that shame, even it doesn't seem to me like that's a normal thing to do, to be disclosive about that, to be honest about that stuff. And it's such a crippling, feels like a matter of survival feeling. Like if I don't fit in, how am I going to live? Like, how am I going to survive? And it's kind of an embarrassment and a, for me, like, I don't know, it makes me cringe. Like it's a cringeful feeling where I feel like I retreat and kind of turn into a little kind of raisin or something. And I feel like I want to just disappear. And to just be aware that wherever we are being countercultural, to expect that that exists there and to seek out support for our counterculturalism, to seek out relationship and community in order for that to have a place that it can be processed rather than continuing the cycle of, oh, I stepped out slightly, now I'm back in line again. Which I often have found, like, doesn't take long for someone to get me back in line.
Hmm.
And then I seek out a conversation that's more helpful to me. And then I think, oh, okay, I can kind of stand outside of that line now.
You know, so shame is just one of the many different phenomena that Francis Weller is pointing out that we might welcome. And boy, do I recognize so much of what you were saying. In fact, we were having, what is it, Sunday morning now, Friday night around our dinner table. We were with some very good friends and we were having a conversation about, among other things, about the work that I do. And my three lovely children were saying, they were saying to me, we have such trouble with our friends at school trying to explain what you do, Dad. And I could, which is right, because there's no single word for the kind of work I know that we get up to in the world that makes sense. And I could feel my own shame at that, you know, it being hard to express and them finding it difficult to express. And they were being so gracious and kind and we were having a really good laugh about it. And I think I'm saying all of this because it strikes me that at least in my own encounter with shame, which I feel very often, what I noticed in what you were saying is that my habitual move, which is the one that I think so many of us know, is to go, oh, I feel shame. I have to do something about feeling shame. I have to get rid of my feeling of shame. And so in order to get rid of my feeling of shame, I will bend myself out of shape or retreat. I love this being a raisin that you said, you know, I'll become like a tiny little shriveled up raisin, or I'll fight back, or I'll, you know, all of these sort of protective and defensive moves that we make. But once in a while, when things align and I find it in myself, I recognize that my shame is something that we all have. That's the something that tries to keep us in line so that we won't ever be trouble to anything or anyone. And if I manage to say to my shame, come and sit at the table, it's okay, you're welcome. I get it. Shame. There is something here about my worries about how I look to other people and what they might think. Come and sit with me. It's okay. You can be here. Then it becomes more possible. And in those moments, and that I think is the kind of self-compassion that at least one angle that Francis Weller is talking about. And then it's possible to really talk with the people who I'm talking with, even if they're upset or whatever. And the place that I learn about this the most is every time I take a taxi, I'm in the in the habit of talking to the driver about their own lives. I love it, I find it super interesting. And every now and again, quite often actually, person who's driving, after I've asked them about their life, will say, well, tell me about you. And very often at that point, I can feel all of this shame that you're talking about come up. But also when I welcome it and I find in myself to say what's true, so often I have got met by the person who's driving, who's gone, oh, I get it. So, and they'll say back to me what it is with great warmth and welcome and appreciation. And that's when I remember what it is that Francis Weller is talking about, because it's when we can do that for ourselves, it's actually possible to do whatever it is that we're here to do, however strange it is or however conventional it is. And I suspect that most of us are more strange than we, simultaneously more conventional and more strange than we will admit to. You know, we have to wash the dishes and pay the bills, and we're also weird and wonderful and unique expressions of life arising in this particular place. And it's our, what's called for is to allow for all of that.
Yeah. I'm just feeling just in this kind of renewed commitment to welcome all parts of me and all parts of others, and see what I can do to continue deepening my cultivation of this curiosity and receptivity that Francis talks about. I can feel it. It's like, I know that's what I need to be doing. Like it's a real calling. And it's interesting because there's a distinction between curiosity and receptivity and healing all the parts of myself that are messed up so I can welcome them. You know, it doesn't feel like there's a demand in curiosity and receptivity. Like a demand to fix myself or make myself into a different person, but just to open. And opening feels more possible than changing something about myself so that I can be better at being accepting or something. So I feel really committed to that and really grateful for this inquiry and grateful for Francis Weller. My goodness. Mm. I mean, so this book, it's like every sentence is a piece of wild poetry that I like, my goodness, I have to keep going back. And it's got, you know, it's got little markers everywhere and bits of pen everywhere, and it's just extraordinary. So I feel very, very grateful for that, and that people dedicate their lives in this way to these inquiries. It's absolutely extraordinary. Mm. I'm very grateful for that right now.
I know we are right up against time, but I want to sneak in sharing a practice that I have learned that as I'm practicing it is proving incredibly helpful with this invitation. I may have said this before. I learned this from reading Mark Nepo, whose work we've brought in many times. And it's very simple, which is particularly when I find myself caught in some kind of self-abandonment or shame, is to look around me at everything and everyone, and to find qualities in everything and to say to myself very quietly, I am like that. So for example, is to look at the crooked tree in my back garden and say, I'm crooked like that tree. Or to look at the hard floor and say, I'm hard like the floor. Or to feel the bright sunshine and say, I'm bright like the sunshine. It's really, or I'm shadowy like the shadow, or I'm mucky like the mud, or you know, all of that. And is to keep on using the world as a reminder of what to welcome in myself, because it turns out everything we find in ourselves we find in the world if we'll look.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to include it because it's been, sometimes I think when we read and talk about all of this, it can feel so compelling and useful and interesting, and then we wonder how might we even begin.
Yeah.
And this has been one way. And it's a very small way that I'm finding of keeping on doing this again and again, which doesn't leave it all up to me. The piano can help me, and the table can help me, and the mug can help me, and you can help me, and
yeah,
all of that.
Oh, I have to add something then.
Mm.
So, you know, sometimes you have this practice of gratitudes. So I think it's quite common sometimes, maybe, to do all the things I was grateful for today, or all the things I was grateful for this morning. And you just have 10 spots in your journal and you write the things that you're grateful for. So I developed this little practice for myself, which is all the things I appreciate about myself today. And by that, I mean all the things that were easy to see that I appreciated about myself, but also when things went wrong, to look through the lens of appreciation of self. So like when I had an argument with Matthew, there are all kinds of ways I could attack myself for what I said and what I did, but there will always be something in there that I can appreciate about myself, to practice what it is to see through the eyes of appreciation in this one. And even when, and especially when things go wrong, our goodness will be there if we took it, good intention, what we intended to happen, what we were deeply committed to, all of those things. And that has really helped me over the years to become including of more than just my self-attack.
Yes.
And that helps me also then see it in other people too. But if I start with this one and just have 10 slots in my little journal and I write down the things I appreciate about myself. And by the way, sometimes can feel excruciating because it goes against the, well, you should beat yourself over the head until you get better. Completely counter to that. There's a complete shift rather than a continuing on with a narrative of self, that the self-hatred that Francis Weller is talking about. So that's my little practice that I do.
Beautiful.
So we are at our time. We're beyond our time, as usual. But thank you so much, everybody, for being here. Thank you, Justin, for this beautiful conversation. And we will be back next week. Can I just also say, my Holly sister, we are together tomorrow night in Hammersmith for our little gathering called Turning Towards Love. And it's 7 till 9 p.m. in Hammersmith. And we'll put the link beneath here. If anybody feels like joining us, we would love to have you.
And I'm going to say that on April the 8th and 9th, you, Lizzie.
Yes.
And Sue from Third Space are both leading, teaching, hosting our Foundations of Coaching program, also known as Coaching to Excellence, in London, in a lovely venue in Hammersmith in London. And there are still places. So we would be so thrilled to have you join us. And you can find out the details of that always at thirdspacecoaching.com, and or if you're in the Facebook group with us, ping us a message in the Facebook group and we can tell you more about it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, everybody, and we'll see you next week at 9 a.m. here on Turning Towards Life.